Hodges doesn't need her to, because he knows what she means for the arrangement. 10 minutes later, he's on the road, headed east towards Sunny Acres and Warsaw County Memorial. He expects to find Janie in the ICU waiting room, but she's outside sitting on the bumper of a parked ambulance. She gets into his Toyota when he pulls up beside her, and one look at her drawn face and socketed eyes tells him everything he needs to know. She holds together until he parks in the visitor's lot, then breaks down. Hodges takes her in his arms. She tells him that Elizabeth Wharton passed from the world at 3:15 Central Daylight Time. About the same time I was putting on my shoes, Hodges thinks, and hugs her tighter.
23. Little League season is in full swing, and Brady spends that sunny Saturday afternoon at McGinnis Park where a full slate of games is being played on 3 fields. The afternoon is warm, and business is brisk. Lots of tweeny bop girls have come to watch their little brothers do battle, and as they stand in line waiting for their ice cream, the only thing they seem to be talking about, the only thing Brady hears them talking about anyway, is the upcoming Round Here concert at the Mac. It seems they are all going. Brady has decided that he will go too. He just needs to dope out a way to get in wearing his special vest, the one loaded with the ball bearings and blocks of plastic explosive. My final bow, he thinks, a headline for the ages. The thought improves his mood. So does selling out his entire truckload of goodies. Even the juicy sticks are gone by 4 o'clock. Back at the ice cream factory, he hands the keys over to Shirley Orton, who never seems to leave, and asks if he can switch with Rudy Stanhope, who's down for the Sunday afternoon shift. Sundays, always assuming the weather cooperates, are busy days, with Loeb's 3 trucks working not just McGinnis, but the city's other 4 large parks. He accompanies his request with the boyishly winning smile Shirley is a sucker for. In other words, Shirley says, you want 2 afternoons off in a row. You got it. He explains that his mother wants to visit her brother, which means at least 1 overnight and possibly 2. There is no brother, of course, and when it comes to trips, the only one his mother is interested in making these days is the scenic tour that takes her from the couch to the liquor cabinet and back to the couch. I'm sure Rudy will say okay. Don't you want to call him yourself? If the request comes from you, it's a done deal. The bitch giggles, which puts acres of flesh in rather disturbing motion. She makes the call while Brady's changing into his street clothes. Rudy is happy to give up his Sunday shift and take Brady's on Tuesday. This gives Brady 2 free afternoons to stake out Zoni's Go-Mart, and 2 should be enough. If the girl doesn't show up with the dog on either day, he'll call in sick on Wednesday, if he has to, but he doesn't think it will take that long. After leaving Loeb's, Brady does a little Krogering of his own. He picks up 6 items they need, staples like eggs, milk, butter, and cocoa puffs, then swings by the meat counter and picks up 1 pound of hamburger. 90% lean. Nothing but the best for Odell's last meal. At home, he opens the garage and unloads everything he bought at Garden World, being careful to put the canisters of Gopher Go on a high shelf. His mother rarely comes out here, but it doesn't do to take chances. There's a mini-fridge under the work table. Brady got it at a yard sale for $7, a total steal. It's where he keeps his soft drinks. He stows the package of hamburger behind the Cokes and Mountain Dews, then totes the rest of the groceries inside. What he finds in the kitchen is delightful. His mother shaking paprika over a tuna salad that actually looks tasty. She catches his look and laughs. I wanted to make up for the lasagna. I'm sorry about that, but I was just so tired. So drunk is what you were, he thinks, but at least she hasn't given up entirely. She pouts her lips, freshly dressed in lipstick. Give Mommy a kiss, honey boy. Honey boy puts his arms around her and gives her a lingering kiss. Her lipstick tastes of something sweet. Then she slaps him briskly on the ass and tells him to go down and play with his computers until dinner's ready. Brady leaves the cop a brief one-sentence message. I'm going to fuck you up, Grandpa. Then he plays Resident Evil until his mother calls him to dinner. The tuna salad is great, and he has two helpings. She actually can cook when she wants, and he says nothing as she pours the first drink of the evening, an extra big one to make up for the two or three smaller ones she denied herself that afternoon. By 9 o'clock, she's snoring on the couch again. Brady uses the opportunity to go online and learn all about the upcoming Round Here concert. He watches a YouTube video where a giggle of girls discusses which of the five boys is the hottest. The consensus is Cam, who sings lead on Look Me in My Eyes, a piece of audio vomit Brady vaguely recalls hearing on the radio last year. He imagines those laughing faces torn apart by ball bearings, those identical guest jeans in burning tatters. Later, after he's helped his mother up to bed and he's sure she's totally conked, he gets the hamburger, puts it in a bowl, and mixes in 2 cups of Gopher Go. If that isn't enough to kill Odell, he'll run the goddamn mud over with the ice cream truck. This thought makes him snicker. He puts the poison hamburger in a baggie and stows it back in the mini-fridge, taking care to hide it behind the cans of soda again. He also takes care to wash both his hands and the mixing bowl in plenty of hot, soapy water. That night, Brady sleeps well. There are no headaches and no dreams about his dead brother. 24. Hodges and Janie are loaned a phone-friendly room down the hall from the hospital lobby, and there they split up the death work. He's the one who gets in touch with the funeral home, Soames, the same one that handled Olivia Trelawney's exit rites, and makes sure the hospital is prepared to release the body when the hearse arrives. Janie, using her iPad with the casual efficiency Hodges envies, downloads an obituary form from the city paper. She fills it out quickly, speaking occasionally under her breath as she does so. Once Hodges hears her murmur the phrase, in lieu of flowers. When the obits emailed back, she produces her mother's address book from her purse and begins making calls to the old lady's few remaining friends. She's warm with them, and calm, but also quick. Her voice wavers only once while she's talking to Althea Green, her mother's nurse and closest companion for almost 10 years. By 6 o'clock, roughly the same time Brady Hartsfield arrives home to find his mother putting the finishing touches on her tuna salad, most of the T's have been crossed and the I's dotted. At 6:50, a white Cadillac hearse pulls into the hospital drive and rolls around back. The guys inside know where to go. They've been here plenty of times. Janie looks at Hodges, her face pale, her mouth trembling. I'm not sure I can. I'll take care of it. The transaction is like any other, really. He gives the mortician and his assistant a signed death certificate. They give him a receipt. He thinks, I could be buying a car. When he comes back to the hospital lobby, he spies Janie outside, once more sitting on the bumper of the ambulance. He sits down next to her and takes her hand. She squeezes his fingers hard. They watch the white hearse until it's out of sight. Then he leads her back to his car, and they drive the 2 blocks to the Holiday Inn. Henry Seroy, a fat man with a moist handshake, shows up at 8. Charlotte Gibney appears an hour later, herding an overloaded bellman ahead of her and complaining about the terrible service on her flight. And the crying babies, she says. You don't want to know. They don't, but she tells them anyway. She's as skinny as her brother is fat, and regards Hodges with a watery, suspicious eye. Lurking by Aunt Charlotte's side is her daughter Holly, a spinster roughly Janie's age, but with none of Janie's looks. Holly Gibney never speaks above a mutter and seems to have a problem making eye contact. I want to see Betty, Aunt Charlotte announces after a brief dry embrace with her niece. It's as if she thinks Mrs. Warden might be laid out in the motel lobby, lilies at her head and carnations at her feet. Janie explains that the body has already been transported to Soames' funeral home in the city, where Elizabeth Wharton's earthly remains will be cremated on Wednesday afternoon after a viewing on Tuesday and a brief non-denominational service on Wednesday morning.
"Cremation is barbaric," Uncle Henry announces.
Everything these two say seems to be an announcement.
"It's what she wanted." Janie speaks quietly, politely, but Hodges observes the color rising in her cheeks.
He thinks there may be trouble, perhaps a demand to see a written document specifying cremation over burial, but they hold their peace.
Perhaps they're remembering all those millions Janie inherited from her sister, money that is Janie's to share, or not. Uncle Henry and Aunt Charlotte might even be considering all the visits they did not make to their elderly sister during her final suffering years. The visits Mrs. Wharton got during those years were made by Olivia, whom Aunt Charlotte does not mention by name, only calling her the one with the problems. And of course it was Janie, still hurting from her abusive marriage and rancorous divorce, who was there at the end. The five of them have a late dinner in the almost deserted Holiday Inn dining room. From the speakers overhead, Herb Alpert toots his horn. Aunt Charlotte has a salad and complains about the dressing, which she has specified should come on the side. They can put it in a little pitcher, but bottled from the supermarket is still bottled from the supermarket, she announces. Her muttering daughter orders something that sounds like Sneezebagel Hellbun. It turns out to be a cheeseburger well done. Uncle Henry opts for fettuccine Alfredo and sucks it down with the efficiency of a high-powered rinse and vac, fine droplets of perspiration appearing on his forehead as he approaches the finish line. He sops up the remains of the sauce with a chunk of buttered bread. Hodges does most of the talking, recounting stories from his days with Vigilant Guard Service. The job is fictional, but the stories are mostly true, adapted from his years as a cop. He tells them about the burglar who got caught trying to squirm through a basement window and lost his pants in his efforts to wriggle free. This earns a small smile from Holly. The 12-year-old boy who stood behind his bedroom door and cold-cocked a home invader with his baseball bat. The housekeeper who stole several pieces of her employer's jewelry only to have them drop out of her underwear while she served dinner. There are darker stories, many of them, that he keeps to himself. Over dessert, which Hodges skips, Uncle Henry's unapologetic gluttony serving as a minatory power of example, Janie invites the new arrivals to stay at the house in Sugar Heights starting tomorrow, and the three of them toddle off to their prepaid rooms. Charlotte and Henry seem cheered by the prospect of inspecting it firsthand just how the other half lives. As for Holly, who knows? The newcomers' rooms are on the first floor. Janie and Hodges are on the third. As they reach the side-by-side doors, she asks if he will sleep with her.
"No sex," she says. "I never felt less sexy in my life. Basically, I just don't want to be alone."
That's okay with Hodges. He doubts if he would be capable of getting up to Dickens anyway. His stomach and leg muscles are still sore from last night, and he reminds himself, last night she did almost all the work. Once they're beneath the coverlet, she snuggles up to him. He can hardly believe the warmth and firmness of her, the there-ness of her. It's true he feels no desire at the moment, but he's glad the old lady had the courtesy to stroke out after he got his ashes hauled rather than before. Not very nice, but there it is. Corrine, his ex, used to say that men were born with a shitty bone.
She pillows her head on his shoulder. "I'm so glad you came."
"Me too. It's the absolute truth."
"Do you think they know we're in bed together?"
Hodges considers. "Aunt Charlotte knows, but she'd know even if we weren't."
"And you can be sure of that because you're a trained..."
"Right. Go to sleep, Janie." She does, but when he wakes up in the early hours of the morning needing to use the toilet, she's sitting by the window looking out at the parking lot and crying. He puts a hand on her shoulder. She looks up.
"I woke you. I'm sorry."
"Nah, this is my usual 3 a.m. pee muster. Are you all right?"
"Yes."
"Yeah." She smiles, then wipes at her eyes with her fisted hands like a child, just hating on myself for shipping Mom off to Sunny Acres. "But she wanted to go, you said."
"Yes, she did. It doesn't seem to change how I feel."
Janie looks at him, eyes bleak and shining with tears. Also hating on myself for letting Olivia do all the heavy lifting while I stayed in California.
As a trained detective, I deduce you were trying to save your marriage.
She gives him a wan smile. You're a good guy, Bill. Go on and use the bathroom.
When he comes back, she's curled up in bed again. He puts his arms around her, and they sleep spoons the rest of the night. 25. Early on Sunday morning, before taking her shower, Janie shows him how to use her iPad. Hodges ducks beneath Debbie's blue umbrella and finds a new message from Mr. Mercedes. It's short and to the point.
I'm going to fuck you up, Grandpa.
Yeah, but tell me how you really feel, he says and surprises himself by laughing.
Janie comes out of the bathroom wrapped in a towel, steam billowing around her like a Hollywood special effect. She asks him what he's laughing about.
Hodges shows her the message. She doesn't find it so funny.
I hope you know what you're doing.
Hodges hopes so, too. Of one thing he's sure. When he gets back home, he'll take the Glock 40 he carried on the job out of his bedroom safe and start carrying it again. The happy slapper is no longer enough. The phone next to the double bed warbles. Janie answers, converses briefly, hangs up.
That was Aunt Charlotte. She suggests the fun crew meet for breakfast in 20 minutes. I think she's anxious to get to Sugar Heights and start checking the silverware.
Okay.
She also shared that the bed was much too hard, and she had to take an allergy pill because of the foam pillows.
Uh-huh. Janie, is Olivia's computer still at the Sugar Heights house?
Sure. In the room she used for her study.
Can you lock that room so they can't get in there?
She pauses in the act of hooking her bra. For a moment frozen in that pose, elbows back, a female archetype. Hell with that. I'll just tell them to keep out. I am not going to be intimidated by that woman. And what about Holly? Can you understand anything she says?
I thought she ordered a sneeze bagel for dinner, Hodges admits.
Janie collapses into the chair he awoke to find her crying in last night, only now she's laughing. Sweetie, you're one bad detective. Which in this sense means good.
Once the funeral stuff is over and they're gone?
Thursday at the latest, she says. If they stay longer, I'll have to kill them.
And no jury on earth would convict you. Once they're gone, I want to bring my friend Jerome in to look at that computer. I'd bring him in sooner, but
they'd be all over him and me.
Hodges, thinking of Aunt Charlotte's bright and inquisitive eyes, agrees.
Won't the blue umbrella stuff be gone? I thought it disappeared every time you left the site.
It's not Debbie's blue umbrella I'm interested in. It's the ghosts your sister heard in the night. 26. As they walk down to the elevator, he asks Janie something that's been troubling him ever since she called yesterday afternoon. Do you think the questions about Olivia brought on your mother's stroke?
She shrugs, looking unhappy. There's no way to tell. She was very old, at least 7 years older than Aunt Charlotte, I think, and the constant pain beat her up pretty badly.
Then, reluctantly,
it could have played a part.
Hodges runs a hand through his hastily combed hair, mussing it again. Ah, Jesus. The elevator dings. They step in. She turns to him and grabs both of his hands. Her voice is swift and urgent.
I'll tell you something, though. If I had to do it over again, I still would. Mom had a long life. Ollie, on the other hand, deserved a few more years. She wasn't terribly happy, but she was doing okay until that bastard got to her. That cuckoo bird. Stealing her car and using it to kill 8 people and hurt I don't know how many more wasn't enough for him, was it? Oh no, he had to steal her mind.
So we push forward.
God damn right we do. Her hands tighten on his. This is ours, Bill. Do you get that? This is ours.
He wouldn't have stopped anyway. The bit is in his teeth, but the vehemence of her reply is good to hear. The elevator doors open. Holly, Aunt Charlotte, and Uncle Henry are waiting in the lobby. Aunt Charlotte regards them with her inquisitive crow's eyes, probably prospecting for what Hodge's old partner used to call the freshly fucked look.
She asks what took them so long, then, without waiting for an answer, tells them that the breakfast buffet looks very thin. If they were hoping for an omelet to order, they're out of luck. Hodges thinks that Janie Patterson is in for several very long days. 27. Like the day before, Sunday is brilliant and summery. Like the day before, Brady sells out by 4, at least 2 hours before dinner time approaches and the parks begin emptying. He thinks about calling home and finding out what his mom wants for supper, then decides to grab takeout from Long John Silver's and surprise her. She loves the Langostino lobster bites. As it turns out, Brady is the one surprised. He comes into the house from the garage, and his greeting, "Hey, Mom, I'm home," dies on his lips. This time, she's remembered to turn off the stove, but the smell of the meat she charred for her lunch hangs in the air. From the living room, there comes a muffled drumming sound and a strange gurgling cry. There's a skillet on one of the front burners. He peers into it and sees crumbles of burnt hamburger rising like small volcanic islands from a film of congealed grease. On the counter is a half-empty bottle of Stoli and a jar of mayonnaise, which is all she ever uses to dress her hamburgers. The grease-spotted takeout bags drop from his hands. Brady doesn't even notice. No, he thinks, it can't be. It is, though. He throws open the kitchen refrigerator, and there on the top shelf is the baggie of poisoned meat. Only now, half of it is gone. He stares at it stupidly, thinking, she never checks the mini-fridge in the garage. Never! That's mine! This is followed by another thought. How do you know what she checks when you're not here? For all you know, she's been through all your drawers and looked under your mattress. That gurgling cry comes again. Brady runs through the living room, kicking one of the Long John Silver's bags under the kitchen table and leaving the refrigerator door open. His mother is sitting bolt upright on the couch. She's in her blue silk lounging pajamas. The shirt is covered with a bib of blood-streaked vomit. Her belly protrudes, straining the buttons. It's the belly of a woman who is 7 months pregnant. Her hair stands out from her parchment-pale face in a mad spray. Her nostrils are clotted with blood. Her eyes bulge. She's not seeing him, or so he thinks at first, but then she holds out her hands. Mom! Mom! His initial idea is to thump her on the back, but he looks at the mostly eaten hamburger on the coffee table next to the remains of what must have been a perfectly enormous screwdriver and knows back thumps will do no good. The stuff's not lodged in her throat. If only it were. The drumming sound he heard when he came in recommences as her feet begin to piston up and down. It's as if she's marching in place. Her back arches. Her arms fly straight up. Now she's simultaneously marching and signaling that the field goal is good. One foot shoots out and kicks the coffee table. Her screwdriver glass falls over. Mom! She throws herself back against the sofa cushions, then forward. Her agonized eyes stare at him. She gurgles a muffled something that might or might not be his name. What do you do for poisoning victims? Was it raw eggs or Coca-Cola? No, Coke's for upset stomachs, and she's gone far beyond that. Have to stick my fingers down her throat, he thinks. Make her gag it up. But then her teeth begin doing their own march, and he pulls his tentatively extended hand back, pressing the palm over his mouth instead. He sees that she has already bitten her lower lip almost to tatters. That's where the blood on her shirt has come from. Some of it, anyway. Bravy! She draws in a hitching breath. What follows is guttural but understandable.
Call 911.
Call 911. He goes to the phone and picks it up before realizing he really can't do that. Think of the unanswerable questions that would ensue. He puts it back down and whirls to her.
Why did you go snooping out there, Mom? Why?
Bravy! Nai wa wan!
When did you eat it? How long has it been?
Instead of answering, she begins to march again. Her head snaps up, and her bulging eyes regard the ceiling for a second or two before her head snaps forward again. Her back doesn't move at all. It's as if her head is mounted on bearings. The gurgling sounds return, the sounds of water trying to go down a partially clogged drain. Her mouth yawns, and she belches vomit. It lands in her lap with a wet splat, and oh God, it's half-blood. He thinks of all the times he's wished her dead. But I never wanted it to be like this, he thinks. Never like this. An idea lights up his mind like a single bright flare over a stormy ocean. He can find out how to treat her online. Everything's online. I'm going to take care of it, he says, but I have to go downstairs for a few minutes. You hang in there, Mom. Try, he almost says, try to relax. He runs into the kitchen toward the door that leads to his control room. Down there, he'll find out how to save her. And even if he can't, he won't have to watch her die. 28. The word to turn on the lights is control, but although he speaks it three times, the basement remains in darkness. Brady realizes the voice recognition program isn't working because he doesn't sound like himself, and is it any wonder? Any fucking wonder at all? He uses the switch instead and goes down, first shutting the door and the beastly sounds coming from the living room behind him. He doesn't even try to voice act his bank of computers, just turns on his number 3 with the button behind the monitor. The countdown to total erasure appears and he stops it by typing in his password. But he doesn't seek out poison antidotes. It's far too late for that. And now that he's sitting here in his safe place, he allows himself to know it. He also knows how this happened. She was good yesterday, staying sober long enough to make a nice supper for them, so she rewarded herself today. Got schnockered, then decided she'd better eat a little something to soak up the booze before her honey boy got home. Didn't find anything in the pantry or the refrigerator that tickled her fancy. Oh, but say, what about the mini-fridge in the garage? Soft drinks wouldn't interest her, but perhaps there were snacks. Only what she found was even better, a baggie filled with nice, fresh hamburger. It makes Brady think of an old saying, whatever can go wrong, will go wrong. Is that the Peter principle? He goes online to find out. After some investigation, he discovers it's not the Peter principle, but Murphy's Law. Named after a man named Edward Murphy. The guy made aircraft parts. Who knew? He surfs a few other sites, actually quite a few, and plays a few hands of solitaire. When there's a particularly loud thump from upstairs, he decides to listen to a few tunes on his iPod. Something cheery. The Staple Singers, maybe. And as Respect Yourself plays in the middle of his head, he goes on Debbie's Blue Umbrella to see if there's a message from the fat ex-cop. 29. When he can put it off no longer, Brady creeps upstairs. Twilight has come. The smell of seared hamburger is almost gone, but the smell of puke is still strong. He goes into the living room. His mother is on the floor next to the coffee table, which is now overturned. Her eyes glare up at the ceiling. Her lips are pulled back in a great big grin. Her hands are claws. She's dead. Brady thinks, why did you have to go out in the garage when you got hungry? Oh, Mom. Mommy. What in God's name possessed you? Whatever can go wrong will go wrong, he thinks. And then, looking at the mess she's made, he wonders if they have any carpet cleaner. This is Hodge's fault. It all leads back to him. He'll deal with the old debt rat, and soon. Right now, though, he has a more pressing problem. He sits down to consider it, taking the chair he uses on the occasions when he watches TV with her. He realizes
she'll never watch another reality show. It's sad, but it does have its funny side. He imagines Jeff Probst sending flowers with a card reading, "From all your survivor pals," and he just has to chuckle. What is he to do with her? The neighbors won't miss her because she never ever had anything to do with them, called them stuck up. She has no friends either, not even of the barfly type, because she did all her drinking at home. Once, in a rare moment of self-appraisal, she told him she didn't go out to the bars because they were full of drunks just like her. "That's why you didn't taste that shit and stop, isn't it?" he asked the corpse. "You were too fucking loaded." He wishes they had a freezer case. If they did, he'd cram her body into it. He saw that in a movie once. He doesn't dare put her in the garage. That seems a little too public, somehow. He supposes he could wrap her in a rug and take her down to the basement. She'd certainly fit under the stairs. But how would he get any work done knowing she was there? Knowing that, even inside a roll of rug, her eyes were glaring? Besides, the basement's his place. His control room. In the end, he realizes there's only one thing to do. He grabs her under the arms and drags her toward the stairs. By the time he gets her there, her pajama pants have slid down, revealing what she sometimes called, he reminds himself, her winky. Once, when he was in bed with her, and she was giving him relief for a particularly bad headache, he tried to touch her winky, and she slapped his hand away, hard. "Don't you ever," she had said. "That's where you came from." Brady pulls her up the stairs, a riser at a time. The pajama pants work down to her ankles and puddle there. He remembers how she did a sit-down march on the couch in her last extremity. How awful. But like the thing about Jeff Probst sending flowers, it had its funny side, although it wasn't the kind of joke you could explain to people. It was kind of zen. Down the hall, into her bedroom, he straightens up, wincing at the pain in his lower back. God, she's so heavy. It's as if death has stuffed her with some dense mystery meat. Never mind. Get it done. He yanks up her pants, making her decent again, as decent as a corpse in vomit-soaked PJs can be, and lifts her onto her bed, groaning as fresh pain settles into his back. When he straightens up this time, he can feel his spine crackling. He thinks about taking off her nightclothes and replacing them with something clean, one of the XL t-shirts she sometimes wears to bed, maybe, but that would mean more lifting and manipulation of what is now just pounds of silent flesh hanging from bone coat hangers. What if he threw his back out? He could at least take off her top. That caught most of the mess, but then he'd have to look at her boobs. Those she did let him touch, but only once in a while. "My handsome boy," she'd say on these occasions, running her fingers through his hair or massaging his neck where the headache settled, crouched and snarling. "My handsome honey boy." In the end, he just pulls the bedspread up, covering her entirely, especially those staring, glaring eyes. "Sorry, Mom," he says, looking down at the white shape. "Not your fault." "No. It's the FedEx cop's fault. Brady bought the gopher goat to poison the dog, true, but only as a way of getting to Hodges and messing with his head. Now it's Brady's head that's a mess, not to mention the living room. He's got a lot of work to do down there, but he has something else to do first." 30. He's got control of himself again, and this time his voice commands work. He doesn't waste time. Just sits down in front of his number 3 and logs on to Debbie's blue umbrella. His message to Hodges is brief and to the point. "I'm going to kill you. You won't see me coming." Call for the dead. 1. On Monday,
2 days after Elizabeth Wharton's death, Hodges is once more seated in DiMaggio's Italian Ristorante. The last time he was here, it was for lunch with his old partner. This time it's dinner. His companions are Jerome Robinson and Janelle Patterson. Janie compliments him on his suit, which already fits better even though he's only lost a few pounds, and the Glock he's wearing on his hip hardly shows at all. It's the new hat Jerome likes, a brown fedora Janie bought Hodges on impulse that very day and presented to him with some ceremony. Because he's a private detective now, she said, and every private dick should have a fedora he can pull down to one eyebrow. Jerome tries it on and gives it that exact tilt.
What do you think? Do I look like Bogey?
I hate to disappoint you, Hodges says, but Bogey was Caucasian.
So Caucasian he practically shimmered, Janie adds.
Forgot that. Jerome tosses the hat back to Hodges, who places it under his chair, reminding himself not to forget it when he leaves, or step on it. He's pleased when his two dinner guests take to each other at once. Jerome, an old head on top of a young body, Hodges often thinks, does the right thing as soon as the ice-breaking foolishness of the hat is finished, taking one of Janie's hands in both of his and telling her he's sorry for her loss.
Both of them, he says. I know you lost your sister, too. If I lost mine, I'd be the saddest guy on earth. Barb's a pain, but I love her to death. She thanks him with a smile. Because Jerome's still too young for a legal glass of wine, they all order iced tea. Janie asks him about his college plans, and when Jerome mentions the possibility of Harvard, she rolls her eyes and says, "A Harvard man? Oh my God."
"Massa Hodges gonna have to find himself a new lawn boy," Jerome exclaims, and Janie laughs so hard she has to spit a bite of shrimp into her napkin. It makes her blush, but Hodges is glad to hear that laugh. Her carefully applied makeup can't completely hide the pallor of her cheeks or the dark circles under her eyes. When he asks her how Aunt Charlotte, Uncle Henry, and Holly the Mumbler are enjoying the big house in Sugar Heights, Janie grabs the sides of her head as if afflicted with a monster headache.
"Aunt Charlotte called 6 times today. I'm not exaggerating, 6. The first time was to tell me that Holly woke up in the middle of the night, didn't know where she was, and had a panic attack. Auntie C said she was on the verge of calling an ambulance when Uncle Henry finally got her settled down by talking to her about NASCAR. She's crazy about stock car racing. Never misses it on TV, I understand. Jeff Gordon is her idol," Janie shrugs. "Go figure." "How old is this Holly?" Jerome asks. "About my age, but she suffers from a certain amount of emotional retardation, I guess you'd say."
Jerome considers this silently, then says, "She probably needs to reconsider Kyle Busch."
"Who?"
"Never mind."
Janie says Aunt Charlotte has also called to marvel over the monthly electrical bill, which must be huge, to confide that the neighbors seem very standoffish, to announce there is an awfully large number of pictures and all that modern art is not to her taste, to point out, although it sounds like another announcement, that if Olivia thought all those lamps were carnival glass, she had almost certainly been taken to the cleaners. The last call, received just before Janie left for the restaurant, had been the most aggravating. Uncle Henry wanted Janie to know, her aunt said, that he had looked into the matter and it still wasn't too late to change her mind about the cremation. She said the idea made her brother very upset. He called it a Viking funeral, and Holly wouldn't even discuss it because it gave her the horrors.
"Their Thursday departure is confirmed," Janie says, "and I'm already counting the minutes." She squeezes Hodges' hand and says, "There's one bit of good news, though. Auntie C says that Holly was very taken with you." Hodges smiles. "Must be my resemblance to Jeff Gordon." Janie and Jerome order dessert. Hodges, feeling virtuous, does not. Then, over coffee, he gets down to business. He has brought 2 folders with him and hands one to each of his dinner companions. "All my notes. I've organized them as well as I can. I want you to have them in case anything happens to me." Janie looks alarmed.
"What else has he said to you on that site?"
"Nothing at all," Hodges says. The lie comes out smoothly and convincingly. "It's just a precaution."
"You sure of that?" Jerome asks.
"Absolutely. There's nothing definitive in the notes, but that doesn't mean we haven't made progress. I see a path of investigation that might, I repeat, might,
take us to this guy. In the meantime, it's important that you both remain very aware of what's going on around you at all times.
Blow our asses off, Janie says.
Right, he turns to Jerome. And what specifically are you going to be on the lookout for?
The reply is quick and sure. Repeat vehicles, especially those driven by males on the younger side, say between the ages of 25 and 40. Although I think 40's pretty old, which makes you practically ancient, Bill.
Nobody loves a smartass, Hodges says. Experience will teach you that in time, young man.
Elaine, the hostess, drifts over to ask how everything was. They tell her everything was fine, and Hodges asks for more coffee all around.
Right away, she says. You're looking much better than the last time you were here, Mr. Hodges, if you don't mind me saying so.
Hodges doesn't mind. He feels better than the last time he was here. Lighter than the loss of 7 or 8 pounds can account for.
When Elaine's gone and the waitress has poured more coffee, Janie leans over the table with her eyes fixed on his.
What path? Tell us.
He finds himself thinking of Donald Davis, who has confessed to killing not only his wife but 5 other women at rest stops along the highways of the Midwest. Soon the handsome Mr. Davis will be in state where he will no doubt spend the rest of his life.
Hodges has seen it all before. He's not so naive as to believe that every homicide is solved, but more often than not, murder does out. Something, a certain wifely body in a certain abandoned gravel pit, for instance, comes to light. It's as if there's a fumble-fingered but powerful universal force at work, always trying to put wrong things right. The detectives assigned to a murder case read reports, interview witnesses, work the phones, study forensic evidence, and wait for that force to do its job. When it does, if it does, a path appears. It often leads straight to the doer, the sort of person Mr. Mercedes refers to in his letters as a perk. Hodges asks his dinner companions, what if Olivia Trelawney actually did hear ghosts?
2. In the parking lot, standing next to the used but serviceable Jeep Wrangler his parents gave him as a 17th birthday present, Jerome tells Janie how good it was to meet her and kisses her cheek. She looks surprised but pleased. Jerome turns to Hodges. You all set, Bill? Need anything tomorrow?
Just for you to look into that stuff we talked about so you'll be ready when we check out Olivia's computer.
I'm all over it.
Good. And don't forget to give my best to your dad and mom.
Jerome grins. Tell you what, I'll pass your best on to Dad. As for Mom, Tyrone Feelgood Delight makes a brief cameo appearance.
I'll be stepping round Adelaide for the next week or so.
Hodges raises his eyebrows. Are you in Dutch with your mother? That doesn't sound like you.
Nah, she's just grouchy. And I can relate, Jerome snickers.
What are you talking about?
Oh, man, there's a concert at the Mac Thursday night. This dopey boy band called Round Here. Barb and her friend Hilda and a couple of their other friends are insane to see them, although they're as vanilla pudding as can be.
How old's your sister? Janie asks.
9, going on 10. Vanilla pudding's what girls that age like. Take it from a former 11-year-old who was crazy about the Bay City Rollers.
Jerome looks puzzled and she laughs.
If you knew who they were, I'd lose all respect for you.
Anyway, none of them have ever been to a live show, right? I mean, other than Barney or Sesame Street on Ice or something.
So they pestered and pestered, they even pestered me, and finally the moms got together and decided that since it was an early show, the girls could go even if it was a school night as long as one of them did the chaperone thing. They literally drew straws and my mom lost.
He shakes his head. His face is solemn, but his eyes are sparkling.
My mom at the Mac with 3,000 or 4,000 screaming girls between the ages of 8 and 14. Do I have to explain any more about why I'm keeping out of her way?
I bet she has a great time, Janie says. She probably screamed for Marvin Gaye or Al Green not so long ago.
Jerome hops into his Wrangler, gives them a final wave, and pulls out onto Lowbriar.
That leaves Hodges and Janie standing beside Hodges' car in an almost summer night. A quarter moon has risen above the underpass that separates the more affluent part of the city from Lowtown.
He's a good guy, Janie says. You're lucky to have him.
Yeah, Hodges says. I am.
She takes the fedora off his head and puts it on her own, giving it a small but provocative tilt. What's next, detective? Your place?
Do you mean what I hope you mean?
I don't want to sleep alone. She stands on tiptoe to return his hat. If I must surrender my body to make sure that doesn't happen, I suppose I must.
Hodges pushes the button that unlocks his car and says, Never let it be said I failed to take advantage of a lady in distress.
You are no gentleman, sir, she says, then adds, Thank God, let's go.
3.
It's better this time because they know each other a little. Anxiety has been replaced by eagerness. When the lovemaking is done, she slips into one of his shirts. It's so big her breasts disappear completely and the tails hang down to the backs of her knees, and explores his small house. He trails her a bit anxiously. She renders her verdict after they've returned to the bedroom.
Not bad for a bachelor pad. No dirty dishes in the sink, no hair in the bathtub, no porn videos on top of the TV. I even spied a green vegetable or two in the crisper, which earns you bonus points.
She's filched 2 cans of beer from the fridge and touches hers to his.
I never expected to be here with another woman, Hodges says, except maybe for my daughter. We talk on the phone and email, but Allie hasn't actually visited in a couple of years.
Did she take your ex's side in the divorce?
I suppose she did.
Hodges has never thought about it in exactly those terms.
If so, she was probably right too.
You might be too hard on yourself.
Hodges sips his beer. It tastes pretty good. As he sips again, a thought occurs to him.
Does Aunt Charlotte have this number, Janie?
No way.
That's not the reason I wanted to come here instead of going back to the condo, but I'd be a liar if I said it never crossed my mind. She looks at him gravely.
Will you come to the memorial service on Wednesday? Say you will. Please. I need a friend.
Of course. I'll be at the viewing on Tuesday as well.
She looks surprised, but happily so. That seems above and beyond.
Not to Hodges, it doesn't. He's in full investigative mode now, and attending the funeral of someone involved in a murder case, even peripherally, is standard police procedure. He doesn't really believe Mr. Mercedes will turn up at either the viewing or the service on Wednesday, but it's not out of the question. Hodges hasn't seen today's paper, but some alert reporter might well have linked Mrs. Wharton and Olivia Trelawney, the daughter who committed suicide after her car was used as a murder weapon. Such a connection is hardly news, but you could say the same about Lindsay Lohan's adventures with drugs and alcohol. Hodges thinks there might at least have been a sidebar. I want to be there, he says. What's the deal with the ashes?
The mortician called them the cremains, she says, and wrinkles her nose the way she does when she mocks his yeah. Is that gross or what? It sounds like something you'd pour in your coffee. On the upside, I'm pretty sure I won't have to fight Aunt Charlotte or Uncle Henry for them.
No, you won't have to do that.
Is there going to be a reception? Janie sighs. Auntie C insists. So the service at 10, followed by a luncheon at the house in Sugar Heights. While we're eating catered sandwiches and telling our favorite Elizabeth Wharton stories, the funeral home people will take care of the cremation. I'll decide what to do with the ashes after the 3 of them leave on Thursday. They'll never even have to look at the urn.
That's a good idea.
Thanks. But I dread the luncheon. Not Mrs. Green and the rest of Mom's few old friends, but them. If Aunt Charlotte freaks, Holly's apt to have a meltdown. You'll come to lunch too, won't you?
If you let me reach inside that shirt you're wearing, I'll do anything you want.
In that case, let me help you with the buttons.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Mr. Mercedes by Stephen King.
4. not many miles from where Kermit William Hodges and Janelle Patterson are lying together in the house on Harper Road, Brady Hartsfield is sitting in his control room. Tonight, he's at his work table instead of his bank of computers, and doing nothing. Nearby, lying amid the litter of small tools, bits of wire, and computer components, is the Monday paper, still rolled up inside its thin plastic condom. He brought it in when he got back from Discount Electronics, but only from force of habit. He has no interest in the news. He has other things to think about. How he's going to get the cop. How he's going to get into the Round Here concert at the Mac wearing his carefully constructed suicide vest. If he really intends to do it, that is. Right now it all seems like an awful lot of work. A long row to hoe. A high mountain to climb. But he can't think of any other similes. Or are those metaphors? Maybe, he thinks drearily, I just ought to kill myself now and be done with it. Get rid of these awful thoughts. These snapshots from hell. Snapshots like the one of his mother, for instance, convulsing on the sofa after eating the poisoned meat meant for the Robinson's family dog. Mom with her eyes bugging out and her pajama shirt covered with puke. How would that picture look in the old family album? He needs to think, but there's a hurricane going on in his head, a big bad Category 5 Katrina, and everything is flying. His old Boy Scout sleeping bag is spread out on the basement floor on top of an air mattress he scrounged from the garage. The air mattress has a slow leak. Brady supposes he ought to replace it if he means to continue sleeping down here for whatever short stretch of life remains to him. And where else can he sleep? He can't bring himself to use his bed on the second floor, not with his mother lying dead in her own bed just down the hall, maybe already rotting her way into the sheets. He's turned on her air conditioner and cranked it up to high cool, but he's under no illusions about how well that will work, or for how long. Nor is sleeping on the living room couch an option. He cleaned it as well as he could and turned the cushions, but it still smells of her vomit. No, it has to be down here in his special place, his control room. Of course, the basement has its own unpleasant history. It's where his little brother died. Only, died is a bit of a euphemism, and it's a bit late for those. Brady thinks about how he used Frankie's name when he posted to Olivia Trelawney under Debbie's blue umbrella. It was as if Frankie was alive again for a little while. Only when the Trelawney bitch died, Frankie died with her. Died again.
I never liked you anyway,
he says, looking toward the foot of the stairs. It is a strangely childish voice, high and treble, but Brady doesn't notice.
And I had to,
he pauses.
We had to.
He thinks of his mother and how beautiful she was in those days. Those old days.
5. Deborah Ann Hartsfield was one of those rare ex-cheerleaders who, even after bearing children, managed to hang on to the body that had danced and pranced its way along the sidelines under the Friday night lights. Tall, full-figured, honey-haired. During the early years of her marriage, she took no more than a glass of wine with dinner. Why drink to excess when life was good sober? She had her husband. She had her house on the north side of the city. Not exactly a palace, but what starter home was, and she had her two boys. At the time his mother became a widow, Brady was 8 and Frankie was 3. Frankie was a plain child and a bit on the slow side. Brady, on the other hand, had good looks and quick wits. Also, what a charmer. She doted on him, and Brady felt the same about her. They spent long Saturday afternoons cuddled together on the couch under a blanket, watching old movies and drinking hot chocolate, while Norm puttered in the garage and Frankie crawled around on the carpet, playing with blocks or a little fire truck that he liked so well he had given it a name, Sammy. Norm Hartsfield was a lineman for Central States Power. He made a good salary pole climbing, but had his sights trained on bigger things. Perhaps it was those things he was eyeing instead of watching what he was doing that day beside Route 51, or maybe he just lost his balance a little and reached the wrong way in an effort to steady himself. No matter what the reason, the result was lethal. His partner was just reporting that they'd found the outage and repair was almost complete when he heard a crackling sound. That was 20,000 volts of coal-fired CSP electricity pouring into Norm Hartsfield's body. The partner looked up just in time to see Norm tumble out of the cherry picker basket and plunge 40 feet to the ground with his left hand melted in the sleeve of his uniform shirt on fire. Addicted to credit cards, like most middle Americans as the end of the century approached, the Hartsfields had savings of less than $2,000. That was pretty thin, but there was a good insurance policy, and CSP kicked in an additional $70,000, trading it for Deborah Ann's signature on a paper absolving the company of all blame in the matter of Norman Hartsfield's death. To Deborah Ann, that seemed like a huge bucketful of cash. She paid off the mortgage on the house and bought a new car. Never did it occur to her that some buckets fill but once. She had been working as a hairdresser when she met Norm and went back to that trade after his death. 6 months or so into her widowhood, she began seeing a man she had met one day at the bank. Only a junior executive, she told Brady, but he had what she called prospects. She brought him home. He ruffled Brady's hair and called him Champ. He ruffled Frankie's hair and called him Little Champ. Brady didn't like him. He had big teeth like a vampire in a scary movie. But he didn't show his dislike. He had already learned to wear a happy face and keep his feelings to himself. One night before taking Deborah Ann out to dinner, the boyfriend told Brady, "Your mother's a charmer, and so are you." Brady smiled and said thank you and hoped the boyfriend would get in a car accident and die. As long as his mother wasn't with him, that was. The boyfriend with the scary teeth had no right to take his father's place. That was Brady's job. Frankie choked on the apple during The Blues Brothers. It was supposed to be a funny movie. Brady didn't see what was so funny about it, but his mother and Frankie laughed fit to split. His mother was happy and all dressed up because she was going out with her boyfriend. In a little while, the sitter would come in. The sitter was a stupid, greedy guts who always looked in the refrigerator to see what was good to eat as soon as Deborah Ann left, bending over so her fat ass stuck out. There were two snack bowls on the coffee table. One contained popcorn, the other apple slices dusted with cinnamon. In one part of the movie, people sang in church and one of the Blues Brothers did flips all the way up the center aisle. Frankie was sitting on the floor and laughed hard when the fat Blues Brother did his flips. When he drew in breath to laugh some more, he sucked a piece of cinnamon-dusted apple slice down his throat. That made him stop laughing. He began to jerk around and claw at his neck instead. Brady's mother screamed and grabbed him in her arms. She squeezed him, trying to make the piece of apple come out. It didn't. Frankie's face went red. She reached into his mouth and down his throat, trying to get at the piece of apple. She couldn't. Frankie started to lose the red color. "Oh, my dear Jesus," Deborah Ann cried and ran for the phone. As she picked it up, she shouted at Brady, "Don't just sit there like an asshole. Pound him on the back." Brady didn't like to be shouted at, and his mother had never called him an asshole before, but he pounded Frankie on the back. He pounded hard. The piece of apple slice did not come out. Now Frankie's face was turning blue. Brady had an idea. He picked Frankie up by his ankles so Frankie's head hung down and his hair brushed the rug. The apple slice did not come out. "Stop being a brat, Frankie," Brady said. Frankie continued to breathe, sort of. He was making little breezy whistling noises anyway, almost until the ambulance got there. Then he stopped. The ambulance men came in. They were wearing black clothes with yellow patches on the jackets. They made Brady go into the kitchen so Brady didn't see what they did, but his mother screamed, and later he saw drops of blood on the carpet. No apple slice, though. Then everyone except Brady went away in the ambulance.
He sat on the couch and ate popcorn and watched TV. Not the Blues Brothers. The Blues Brothers was stupid. Just a bunch of singing and running around. He found a movie about a crazy guy who kidnapped a bunch of kids who were on their school bus. That was pretty exciting. When the fat sitter showed up, Brady said, Frankie choked on an apple slice. There's ice cream in the refrigerator. Vanilla crunch. Have as much as you want. Maybe, he thought, if she ate enough ice cream, she'd have a heart attack and he could call 911. Or just let the stupid bitch lay there. That would probably be better. He could watch her. Deborah Ann finally came home at 11 o'clock. The fat sitter had made Brady go to bed, but he wasn't asleep, and when he came downstairs in his PJs, his mother hugged him to her. The fat babysitter asked how Frankie was. The fat babysitter was full of fake concern. The reason Brady knew it was fake was because he wasn't concerned, so why would the fat babysitter care? He's going to be fine, Deborah Ann said with a big smile. Then, when the fat babysitter was gone, she started crying like crazy. She got her wine out of the refrigerator, but instead of pouring it into a glass, she drank straight from the neck of the bottle. He might not be, she told Brady, wiping wine from her chin. He's in a coma. Do you know what that is? Sure, like in a doctor show. That's right. She got down on one knee so they were face to face. Having her so close, smelling the perfume she'd put on for the date that never happened, gave him a feeling in his stomach. It was funny, but good. He kept looking at the blue stuff on her eyelids. It was weird, but good. He stopped breathing for a long time before the EMTs could make some room for the air to go down. The doctor at the hospital said that even if he comes out of his coma, there might be brain damage. Brady thought Frankie was already brain damaged. He was awful stupid carrying around that fire truck all the time, but said nothing. His mother was wearing a blouse that showed the tops of her titties. That gave him a funny feeling in his stomach, too. If I tell you something, do you promise never to tell anyone? Not another living soul? Brady promised. He was good at keeping secrets. It might be better if he does die, because if he wakes up and he's brain damaged, I don't know what we'll do. Then she clasped him to her, and her hair tickled the side of his face, and the smell of her perfume was very strong. She said, Thank God it wasn't you, honey boy. Thank God for that. Brady hugged her back, pressing his chest against her titties. He had a boner. Frankie did wake up, and sure enough, he was brain damaged. He had never been smart. Takes after his father, Deborah Ann said once. But compared to the way he was now, he had been a genius in those pre-apple slice days. He had toilet trained late, not until he was almost 3 1/2, and now he was back in diapers. His vocabulary had been reduced to no more than a dozen words. Instead of walking, he made his way around the house in a limping shuffle. Sometimes he fell abruptly and profoundly asleep, but that was only in the daytime. At night he had a tendency to wander, and before he started out on these nocturnal safaris, he usually stripped off his pampers. Sometimes he got into bed with his mother. More often he got in with Brady, who would awake to find the bed soaked and Frankie staring at him with goofy, creepy love. Frankie had to keep going to the doctor. His breathing was never right. At its best, it was a wet wheeze. At its worst, when he had one of his frequent colds, a rattling bark. He could no longer eat solid food. His meals had to be pureed in the blender, and he ate them in a high chair. Drinking from a glass was out of the question, so it was back to sippy cups. The boyfriend from the bank was long gone, and the fat babysitter didn't last either. She said she was sorry, but she just couldn't cope with Frankie the way he was now. For a while, Deborah Ann got a full-time home care lady to come in, but the home care lady ended up getting more money than Deborah Ann made at the beauty shop, so she let the home care lady go and quit her job. Now they were living off savings. She began to drink more, switching from wine to vodka, which she called a more efficient delivery system. Brady would sit with her on the couch drinking Pepsi. They would watch Frankie crawl around on the carpet with his fire truck in one hand and his blue sippy cup, also filled with Pepsi, in the other. "It's shrinking like the ice caps," Deborah Ann would say, and Brady no longer had to ask her what it was. "And when it's gone, we'll be out on the street." She went to see a lawyer, in the same strip mall where Brady would years later flick an annoying goofy boy in the throat, and paid $100 for a consultation. She took Brady with her. The lawyer's name was Greensmith. He wore a cheap suit and kept sneaking glances at Deborah Ann's titties.
"I can tell you what happened," he said. "Seen it before. That piece of apple left just enough space around his windpipe to let him keep breathing. It's too bad you reached down his throat, that's all."
"I was trying to get it out," Deborah Ann said indignantly.
"I know, any good mother would do the same. But you pushed it deeper instead and blocked his windpipe entirely. If one of the EMTs had done that, you'd have a case, worth a few hundred thousand at least. Maybe 1.5 million. Seen it before. But it was you. And you told them what you did, didn't you?"
Deborah Ann admitted she had.
"Did they intubate him?"
Deborah Ann said they did.
"Okay, that's your case. They got an airway into him, but in doing so, they pushed that bad apple in even deeper." He sat back, spread his fingers on his slightly yellowed white shirt, and peeped at Deborah Ann's titties again, maybe just to make sure they hadn't slipped out of her bra and run away. "Hence, brain damage."
"So you'll take the case?"
"Happy to, if you can pay for the 5 years it'll drag through the courts. Because the hospital and their insurance providers will fight you every step of the way, seen it before."
"How much?"
Greensmith named a figure, and Deborah Ann left the office holding Brady's hand. They sat in her Honda, then knew, and she cried. When that part was over, she told him to play the radio while she ran another errand. Brady knew what the other errand entailed, a bottle of efficient delivery system. She relived her meeting with Greensmith many times over the years, always ending with the same bitter pronouncement. "I paid $100 I couldn't afford to a lawyer in a suit from Men's Warehouse, and all I found out was I couldn't afford to fight the big insurance companies and get what was coming to me." The year that followed was 5 years long. There was a life-sucking monster in the house, and the monster's name was Frankie. Sometimes, when he knocked something over or woke Deborah Ann up from a nap, she spanked him. Once, she lost it completely and punched him in the side of the head, sending him to the floor in a twitching, eye-rolling daze. She picked him up and hugged him and cried and said she was sorry, but there was only so much a woman could take. She went into Hair Today as a sub whenever she could. On these occasions, she called Brady in sick at school so he could babysit his little brother. Sometimes Brady would catch Frankie reaching for stuff he wasn't supposed to have, or stuff that belonged to Brady, like his Atari arcade handheld. And then he would slap Frankie's hands until Frankie cried. When the wail started, Brady would remind himself that it wasn't Frankie's fault. He had brain damage from that damn, no, that fucking apple slice, and he would be overcome by a mixture of guilt, rage, and sorrow. He would take Frankie on his lap and rock him and tell him he was sorry, but there was only so much a man could take. And he was a man, Mom said so, the man of the house. He got good at changing Frankie's diapers, but when there was poo, no, it was shit, not poo, but shit, he would sometimes pinch Frankie's legs and shout at him to lay still, damn you, lay still. Even if Frankie was laying still. Laying there with Sammy the fire truck clutched to his chest and looking up at the ceiling with his big, stupid, brain-damaged eyes. That year was full of sometimes. Sometimes he loved Frankie up and kissed him. Sometimes he'd shake him and say, "This is your fault. We're going to have to live in the street, and it's your fault." Sometimes putting Frankie to bed after a day at the beauty parlor, Deborah Ann would see bruises on the boy's arms and legs. Once on his throat, which was scarred from the tracheotomy the EMTs had performed. She never commented on these. Sometimes Brady loved Frankie. Sometimes he hated him. Usually he felt both things at the same time, and it gave him headaches.
Sometimes, mostly when she was drunk, Deborah Ann would rail at the train wreck of her life. I can't get assistance from the city, the state, or the goddamn federal government, and why? Because we still have too much from the insurance and the settlement, that's why. Does anyone care that everything's going out and nothing's coming in? No. When the money's gone and we're living in a homeless shelter on Lowbriar Avenue, then I'll be eligible for assistance. It isn't that just ducky. Sometimes Brady would look at Frankie and think, "You're in the way. You're in the way, Frankie. You're in the fucking goddamn shit-ass way." Sometimes, often, Brady hated the whole fucking goddamn shit-ass world. If there was a God like the Sunday guy said on TV, wouldn't he take Frankie up to heaven so his mother could go back to work full-time and they wouldn't have to be out on the street? Or living on Lowbriar Avenue, where his mother said there was nothing but nigger drug addicts with guns? If there was a God, why had he let Frankie choke on that fucking apple slice in the first place? And then letting him wake up brain damaged afterward? That was going from bad to fucking goddamn shit-ass worse. There was no God. You only had to watch Frankie crawling around the floor with goddamn Sammy in one hand, then getting up and limping for a while before giving that up and crawling again, to know that the idea of God was fucking ridiculous. Finally, Frankie died. It happened fast. In a way, it was like running down those people at City Center. There was no forethought, only the looming reality that something had to be done. You could almost call it an accident. Or fate. Brady didn't believe in God, but he did believe in fate, and sometimes the man of the house had to be fate's right hand. His mother was making pancakes for supper. Frankie was playing with Sammy. The basement door was standing open because Deborah Ann had bought 2 cartons of cheap off-brand toilet paper at Chapter 11 and they kept it down there. The bathrooms needed restocking, so she sent Brady down to get some. His hands had been full when he came back up, so he left the basement door open. He thought Mom would shut it, but when he came down from putting the toilet paper in the 2 upstairs bathrooms, it was still open. Frankie was on the floor pushing Sammy across the linoleum and making sounds. He was wearing red pants that bulged with his triple-thick diapers. He was working ever closer to the open door and the steep stairs beyond, but Deborah Ann still made no move to close the door. Nor did she ask Brady, now setting the table, to do it. Said Frankie. He pushed the fire truck. Sammy rolled to the edge of the basement doorway, bumped against the jamb, and there he stopped. Deborah Ann left the stove. She walked over to the basement door. Brady thought she would bend down and hand Frankie's fire truck back to him, but she didn't. She kicked it instead. There was a small clacking sound as it tumbled down the steps all the way to the bottom. "Oops," she said. "Sammy fall down go boom." Her voice was very flat. Brady walked over. This was interesting. "Why'd you do that, Mom?" Deborah Ann put her hands on her hips, the spatula jutting from one of them. She said, "Because I'm just so sick of listening to him make that sound." Frankie opened his mouth and began to blat. "Quit it, Frankie," Brady said, but Frankie didn't. What Frankie did was crawl onto the top step and peer down into the darkness. In that same flat voice, Deborah Ann said, "Turn on the light, Brady, so he can see Sammy." Brady turned on the light and peered over his blatting brother. "Yep," he said. "There he is, right down at the bottom. See him, Frankie?" Frankie crawled a little farther, still blatting. He looked down. Brady looked at his mother. Deborah Ann Hartsfield gave the smallest, most imperceptible nod. Brady didn't think. He simply kicked Frankie's triple-diapered butt, and down Frankie went, in a series of clumsy somersaults that made Brady think of the fat Blues Brother flipping his way along the church aisle. On the first somersault, Frankie kept on blatting, but the second time around, His head connected with one of the stair risers, and the blatting stopped all at once, as if Frankie were a radio and someone had turned him off. That was horrible, but had its funny side. He went over again, legs flying out limply to either side in a Y shape. Then he slammed head first into the basement floor.
"Oh my God, Frankie fell!"
Deborah Ann cried. She dropped the spatula and ran down the stairs. Brady followed her. Frankie's neck was broken. Even Brady could tell that, because it was all croggled in the back. But he was still alive. He was breathing in little snorts. Blood was coming out of his nose. More was coming from the side of his head. His eyes moved back and forth, but nothing else did. Poor Frankie. Brady started to cry. His mother was crying, too.
"What should we do?" Brady asked. "What should we do, Mom?"
"Go upstairs and get me a pillow off the sofa." He did as she said. When he came back down, Sammy the fire truck was lying on Frankie's chest. "I tried to get him to hold it, but he can't," Deborah Ann said. "Yeah," Brady said. "He's probably paralyzed. Poor Frankie." Frankie looked up, first at his mother, and then his brother.
"Brady,"
he said. "It'll be okay, Frankie," Brady said, and held out the pillow. Deborah Ann took it and put it over Frankie's face. It didn't take long. Then she sent Brady upstairs again to put the sofa pillow back and get a wet washcloth. "Turn off the stove while you're up there," she said. "The pancakes are burning. I can smell them." She washed Frankie's face to get rid of the blood. Brady thought that was very sweet and motherly. Years later, he realized she'd also been making sure there would be no threads or fibers from the pillow on Frankie's face. When Frankie was clean, although there was still blood in his hair, Brady and his mother sat on the basement steps looking at him. Deborah Ann had her arm around Brady's shoulders. "I better call 911, she said. "Okay." He pushed Sammy too hard, and Sammy fell downstairs. Then he tried to go after him and lost his balance. "I was making the pancakes, and you were putting toilet paper in the bathrooms upstairs. You didn't see anything. When you got down to the basement, he was already dead." "Okay. Say it back to me." Brady did. He was an A student in school and good at remembering things. "No matter what anybody asks you, never say more than that. Don't add anything and don't change anything." "Okay. But can I say you were crying?" She smiled. She kissed his forehead and cheek. Then she kissed him full on the lips. "Yes, honey boy, you can say that." "Will we be all right now?" "Yes." There was no doubt in her voice. "We'll be fine." She was right. There were only a few questions about the accident and no hard ones. They had a funeral. It was pretty nice. Frankie was in a Frankie-sized coffin wearing a suit. He didn't look brain damaged, just fast asleep. Before they closed the coffin, Brady kissed his brother's cheek and tucked Sammy the fire truck in beside him. There was just enough room. That night, Brady had the first of his really bad headaches. He started thinking Frankie was under his bed, and that made the headache worse. He went down to his mom's room and got in with her. He didn't tell her he was scared of Frankie being under his bed, just that his head ached so bad he thought it was going to explode. She hugged him and kissed him, and he wriggled against her tight, tight, tight. It felt good to wriggle. It made the headache less. They fell asleep together, and the next day it was just the two of them, and life was better. Deborah Ann got her old job back, but there were no more boyfriends. She said Brady was the only boyfriend she wanted now. They never talked about Frankie's accident, but sometimes Brady dreamed about it. He didn't know if his mother did or not, but she drank plenty of vodka, so much she eventually lost her job again. That was all right, though, because by then he was old enough to go to work. He didn't miss going to college, either. College was for people who didn't know they were smart. 6. Brady comes out of these memories, a reverie so deep it's like hypnosis, to discover he's got a lap full of shredded plastic. At first he doesn't know where it came from. Then he looks at the newspaper lying on his work table and understands he tore apart the bag it was in with his fingernails while he was thinking about Frankie. He deposits the shreds in the waste basket, then picks up the paper and stares vacantly at the headlines. Oil is still gushing into the Gulf of Mexico, and British Petroleum executives are squalling that they're doing the best they can and people are being mean to them. Nadal Hassan, the asshole shrink who shot up the Fort Hood Army base in Texas, is going to be arraigned in the next day or two. You should have had a Mercedes, Nadal, baby, Brady thinks. Paul McCartney, the ex-Beatle Brady's mom used to call Old Spaniel Eyes, is getting a medal at the White House. Why is it, Brady sometimes wonders, that people with only a little talent get so much of everything? It's just another proof that the world is crazy. Brady decides to take the paper up to the kitchen and read the political columns. Those in a melatonin capsule might be enough to send him off to sleep. Halfway up the stairs, he turns the paper over to see what's below the fold and freezes. There are photos of two women side by side. One is Olivia Trelawney. The other one is much older, but the resemblance is unmistakable, especially those thin bitch lips. Mother of Olivia Trelawney dies, the headline reads. Below it, protested daughter's unfair treatment. Claimed press coverage destroyed her life. What follows is a two-paragraph squib, really just an excuse to get last year's tragedy, if you want to use that word, Brady thinks rather snidely, back on the front page of a newspaper that's slowly being strangled to death by the Internet. Readers are referred to the obituary on page 26, and Brady, now sitting at the kitchen table, turns there double-quick. The cloud of dazed gloom that has surrounded him ever since his mother's death has been swept away in an instant. His mind is ticking over rapidly, ideas coming together, flying apart, then coming together again like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. He's familiar with this process and knows it will continue until they connect with a click of finality and a clear picture appears. Elizabeth Seroy Wharton, 87, passed away peacefully on May 29, 2010 at Warsaw County Memorial Hospital. She was born on January 19, 1923, the son of Marcel and Catherine Seroy. She is survived by her brother, Henry Seroy, her sister, Charlotte Gibney, her niece, Holly Gibney, and her daughter, Janelle Patterson. Elizabeth was predeceased by her husband, Alvin Wharton, and her beloved daughter, Olivia. Private visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Soames Funeral Home on Tuesday, June 1, followed by a 10 a.m. memorial service at Soames Funeral Home on Wednesday, June 2. After the service, a reception for close friends and family members will take place at 729 Lilac Drive in Sugar Heights. The family requests no flowers, but suggests contributions to either the American Red Cross or the Salvation Army, Mrs. Wharton's favorite charities. Brady reads all this carefully with several related questions in mind. Will the FedEx cop be at the visitation? At the Wednesday memorial service? At the reception? Brady's betting on all three. Looking for the perk. Looking for him. Because that's what cops do. He remembers the last message he sent to Hodges, the good old dead rat. Now he smiles and says it out loud. He won't see me coming. Make sure he doesn't, Deborah Ann Hartsfield says. He knows she's not really there, but he can almost see her sitting across the table from him, wearing a black pencil skirt and the blue blouse he especially likes, the one that's so filmy you can see the ghost of her underwear through it. Because he'll be looking for you. I know, Brady says. Don't worry. Of course I'll worry, she says. I have to. You're my honey boy. He goes back downstairs and gets into his sleeping bag. The leaky air mattress wheezes. The last thing he does before killing the lights via voice command is to set his iPhone alarm for 6:30. Tomorrow is going to be a busy day.
Except for the tiny red lights marking his sleeping computer equipment, the basement control room is completely dark. From beneath the stairs, his mother speaks.
I'm waiting for you, honey boy, but don't make me wait too long.
I'll be there soon, Mom.
Smiling, Brady closes his eyes.
2 minutes later, he's snoring.
7. Janie doesn't come out of the bedroom until just after 8 the following morning. She's wearing her pantsuit from the night before. Hodges, still in his boxers, is on the phone. He waves one finger to her, a gesture that says both good morning and give me a minute. It's not a big deal, he's saying, just one of those things that nibble at you. If you could check, I'd really appreciate it. He listens. Nah, I don't want to bother Pete with it, and don't you either. He's got all he can handle with the Donald Davis case. He listens some more. Janie perches on the arm of the sofa, points at her watch, and mouths,
The viewing.
Hodges nods. That's right, he says into the phone. Let's say between the summer of 2007 and the spring of 2009. In the Lake Avenue area downtown where all those new ritzy condos are. He winks at Janie. Thanks, Marlo, you're a doll. And I promise I'm not going to turn into an uncle, okay?
Listens, nodding.
Okay. Yeah, I have to run, but give my best to Phil and the kids. We'll get together soon. Lunch. Of course on me. Right. Bye. He hangs up.
You need to get dressed in a hurry, she says. Then take me back to the apartment so I can put on my damn makeup before we go over to the funeral home. It might also be fun to change my underwear. How fast can you hop into your suit?
Fast, and you don't really need the makeup.
She rolls her eyes. Tell that to Aunt Charlotte. She's totally on crow's feet patrol. Now get going and bring a razor. You can shave at my place.
She rechecks her watch.
I haven't slept this late in 5 years.
He heads for the bedroom to get dressed. She catches him at the door, turns him toward her, puts her palms on his cheeks, and kisses his mouth.
Good sex is the best sleeping pill. I guess I forgot that.
He lifts her high off her feet in a hug. He doesn't know how long this will last, but while it does, he means to ride it like a pony.
And wear your hat, she says, looking down into his face and smiling. I did right when I bought it. That hat is you.
8. They're too happy with each other and too intent on getting to the funeral parlor ahead of the relatives from hell to Bolo. But even on red alert, they almost certainly wouldn't have seen anything that rang warning bells. There are already more than 2 dozen cars parked in the little strip mall at the intersection of Harper Road and Hanover Street, and Brady Hartsfield's mud-colored Subaru is the most unobtrusive of the lot. He has picked his spot carefully so that the FedEx cop street is squarely in the middle of his rear view. If Hodges is going to the old lady's viewing, he'll come down the hill and make a left on Hanover. And here he comes at just past 8:30, quite a bit earlier than Brady expected since the viewing's not until 10 and the funeral parlor's only 20 minutes or so away. As the car makes its left turn, Brady is further surprised to see the FedEx cop is not alone. His passenger is a woman, and although Brady only gets a quick glimpse, it's enough for him to ID Olivia Trelawney's sister. She's got the visor down so she can look into the mirror as she brushes her hair. The obvious deduction is that she spent the night in the FedEx cop's bachelor bungalow. Brady is thunderstruck. Why in God's name would she do that? Hodges is old. He's fat. He's ugly. She can't really be having sex with him, can she? The idea is beyond belief. Then he thinks of how his mother relieved his worst headaches and realizes, reluctantly, that when it comes to sex, no pairing is beyond belief. But the idea of Hodges doing it with Olivia Trelawney's sister is infuriating, not in the least because you could say it was Brady himself who brought them together. Hodges is supposed to be sitting in front of his television and contemplating suicide. He has no right to enjoy a jar of Vaseline in his own right hand, let alone a good-looking blonde. Brady thinks, she probably took the bed while he slept on the sofa. This idea at least approaches logic and makes him feel better. He supposes Hodges could have sex with a good-looking blonde if he really wanted to. But he'd have to pay for it. The whore would probably want a weight surcharge, too, he thinks, and laughs as he starts his car. Before pulling out, he opens the glove compartment, takes out Thing 2, and places it on the passenger seat. He hasn't used it since last year, but he's going to use it today. Probably not at the funeral parlor, though, because he doubts they will be going there right away. It's too early. Brady thinks they'll be stopping at the Lake Avenue condo first, and it's not necessary that he beat them there, only that he be there when they come back out. He knows just how he's going to do it. It will be like old times. At a stoplight downtown, he calls Tones Frobisher at Discount Electronics and tells him he won't be in today. Probably not all week. Pinching his nostrils shut with his knuckles to give his voice a nasal honk, he informs Tones that he has the flu. He thinks of the Round Here concert at the Mac on Thursday night in the suicide vest and imagines adding, "Next week I won't have the flu, I'll just be dead." He breaks the connection, drops his phone onto the seat next to Thing 2 and begins laughing. He sees a woman in the next lane, all gussied up for work, staring at him. Brady, now laughing so hard, tears are streaming down his cheeks and snot is running out of his nose, gives her the finger. 9. You were talking to your friend in the records department, Janie asks.
Marlo Everett, yeah, she's always in early. Pete Huntley, my old partner, used to swear that was because she never left.
What fairy tale did you feed her, pray tell?
That some of my neighbors have mentioned a guy trying cars to see if they were unlocked. I said I seemed to recall a spate of car burglaries downtown a couple of years back. The doer never apprehended.
Uh-huh. And that thing you said about not turning into an uncle, what was that about?
Uncles are retired cops who can't let go of the job. They call in wanting Marlo to run the plate numbers of cars that strike them as hinky for one reason or another. Or maybe they brace some guy who looks wrong, go all cop-faced on his ass, and ask for ID. Then they call in and have Marlo run the name for wants and warrants.
Does she mind?
Oh, she bitches about it for form's sake, but I don't really think so. An old geezer named Kenny Shays called in a 6-5 a few years ago. That's suspicious behavior, a new code since 9-11. The guy he pegged wasn't a terrorist, just a fugitive who killed his whole family in Kansas back in 1987.
Wow. Did he get a medal?
Nothing but an attaboy, which was all he wanted. He died 6 months or so later. Ate his gun is what Kenny Shays did, pulling the trigger before the lung cancer could get traction. Hodge's cell phone rings. It's muffled, because he's once more left it in the glove compartment. Janie fishes it out and hands it over with a slightly ironic smile. Hey, Marlo, that was quick. What did you find out? Anything? He listens, nodding along with whatever he's hearing and saying, uh-huh, and never missing a beat in the heavy flow of morning traffic. He thanks her and hangs up, but when he attempts to hand the Nokia back to Janie, she shakes her head.
Put it in your pocket. Someone else might call you. I know it's a strange concept, but try to get your head around it. What did you find out?
Starting in September of 2007, there were over a dozen car break-ins downtown. Marlo says there could have been even more, because people who don't lose anything of value have a tendency not to report car burglaries. Some don't even realize it happened. The last report was logged in March of 2009, less than 3 weeks before the city center massacre. It was our guy, Janie. I'm sure of it. We're crossing his back trail now, and that means we're getting closer.
Good.
I think we're going to find him. If we do, your lawyer, Sean, goes downtown to fill in Pete Huntley. He does the rest. We still see eye to eye on that, don't we?
Yes, but until then, he's ours. We still see eye to eye on that, right?
Absolutely. He's cruising down Lake Avenue now, and there's a spot right in front of the late Mrs. Warden's building. When your luck is running, it's running. Hodges backs in, wondering how many times Olivia Trelawney used this same spot. Janie looks anxiously at her watch as Hodges feeds the meter. Relax, he says. We've got plenty of time. As she heads for the door, Hodges pushes the lock button on his key fob. He doesn't think about it. Mr. Mercedes is what he's thinking about, but habit is habit. He pockets his keys and hurries to catch up with Janie so he can hold the door for her. He thinks, I'm turning into a sap. Then he thinks, so what?
10. 5 minutes later, a mud-colored Subaru cruises down Lake Avenue. It slows almost to a stop when it comes abreast of Hodges' Toyota. Then Brady puts on his left turn blinker and pulls into the parking garage across the street. There are plenty of vacant spots on the first and second levels, but they're all on the inside and no use to him. He finds what he wants on the nearly deserted third level, a spot on the east side of the garage, directly overlooking Lake Avenue. He parks, walks to the concrete bumper, and peers across the street and down at Hodges' Toyota. He puts the distance at about 60 yards. With nothing in the way to block the signal, that's a piece of cake for Thing 2. With time to kill, Brady gets back into his car, fires up his iPad, and investigates the Midwest Culture and Arts Complex website. Mingo Auditorium is the biggest part of the facility. That figures, Brady thinks, because it's probably the only part of the Mac that makes money. The city's symphony orchestra plays there in the winter, plus there are ballets and lectures and arty-farty shit like that. But from June to August, the Mingo is almost exclusively dedicated to pop music. According to the website, Round Here will be followed by an all-star summer cavalcade of song, including the Eagles, Sting, John Mellencamp, Alan Jackson, Paul Simon, and Bruce Springsteen. Sounds good, but Brady thinks the people who bought all concert passes are going to be disappointed. There's only going to be one show in the Mingo this summer, a short one ending with a punk ditty called Die, You Useless Motherfuckers. The website says the auditorium's capacity is 4,500. It also says that the Round Here concert is sold out. Brady calls Shirley Orton at the ice cream factory. Once more pinching his nose shut, he tells her she better put Rudy Stanhope on alert for later in the week. He says he'll try to get in Thursday or Friday, but she better not count on it. He has the flu. As he expected, the F-word alarms Shirley. Don't you come near this place until you can show me a note from your doctor saying you're not contagious. You can't be selling ice cream to kids if you've got the flu.
I'd know, Brady says through his pinched nostrils. I'd be sorry, Shirley. I think I got it from my mother. I had to put her to bed.
That hits his funny bone and his lips begin to twitch.
Well, you take care of yours.
I have to go, he says, and breaks the connection just before another gust of hysterical laughter sweeps through him.
Yes, he had to put his mother to bed. And yes, it was the flu. Not the swine flu or the bird flu, but a new strain called gopher flu. Brady howls and pounds the dashboard of his Subaru. He pounds so hard he hurts his hand, and that makes him laugh harder still. This fit goes on until his stomach aches, and he feels a little like puking. It has just begun to ease off when he sees the lobby door of the condo across the street open. Brady snatches up Thing 2 and slides the on switch. The ready lamp glows yellow. He raises the short stub of the antenna. He gets out of his car, not laughing now, and creeps to the concrete bumper again, being careful to stay in the shadow of the nearest support pillar. He puts his thumb on the toggle switch and angles Thing 2 down, but not at the Toyota. He's aiming at Hodges, who is rummaging in his pants pocket. The blonde is next to him, wearing the same pantsuit she had on earlier, but with different shoes and purse. Hodges brings out his keys. Brady pushes Thing 2's toggle switch, and the yellow ready lamp turns operational green. The lights of Hodges' car flash. At the same instant, the green light on Thing 2 gives a single quick blink. It has caught the Toyota's PKE code and stored it, just as it caught the code of Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes. Brady used Thing 2 for almost 2 years, stealing PKEs and unlocking cars so he could toss them for valuables and cash. The income from these ventures was uneven, but the thrill never faded. His first thought on finding the spare key in the glove compartment of Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes, it was in a plastic bag along with her owner's manual and registration, was to steal the car and joyride it all the way across the city. Bang it up a little just for the hell of it. Maybe slice the upholstery. But some instinct had told him to leave everything just as it was, that the Mercedes might have a larger role to play. And so it had proved. Brady hops into his car and puts Thing 2 back in his own glove compartment.
He's very satisfied with his morning's work, but the morning isn't over. Hodges and Olivia's sister will be going to a visitation. Brady has his own visitation to make. The Mac will be open by now, and he wants a look around. See what they have for security. Check out where the cameras are mounted. Brady thinks, I'll find a way in. I'm on a roll. Also, he'll need to go online and score a ticket to the concert Thursday night. Busy, busy, busy. He begins to whistle. 11. Hodges and Janie Patterson step into the eternal rest parlor of the Soames funeral home at 9:45, and thanks to her insistence on hurrying, they're the first arrivals. The top half of the coffin is open. The bottom half is swaddled in a blue silk swag. Elizabeth Wharton is wearing a white dress sprigged with blue florets that match the swag. Her eyes are closed, her cheeks are rosy. Janie hurries down an aisle between two ranks of folding chairs, looks briefly at her mother, then hurries back. Her lips are trembling. Uncle Henry can call cremation pagan if he wants to, but this open coffin shit is the real pagan rite. She doesn't look like my mother. She looks like a stuffed exhibit. Then why? It was the trade-off I made to shut Uncle Henry up about the cremation. God help us if he looks under the swag and sees the coffin's pressed cardboard painted gray to look like metal. So it'll... You know. I know, Hodges says, and gives her a one-armed hug. The deceased woman's friends trickle in, led by Althea Green, Warden's nurse, and Mrs. Harris, who was her housekeeper. At 9:20 or so, fashionably late, Hodges thinks, Aunt Charlotte arrives on her brother's arm. Uncle Henry leads her down the aisle, looks briefly at the corpse, then stands back. Aunt Charlotte stares fixedly into the upturned face, then bends and kisses the dead lips. In a barely audible voice, she says, Oh, sis. Oh, sis. For the first time since he met her, Hodges feels something for her other than irritation. There is some milling, some quiet talk, a few low outbursts of laughter. Janie makes the rounds, speaking to everyone. There aren't more than a dozen, all of the sort Hodges' daughter calls Goldie Oldies, doing her due diligence. Uncle Henry joins her, and on the one occasion when Janie falters, she's trying to comfort Mrs. Green, he puts an arm around her shoulders. Hodges is glad to see it. Blood tells, he thinks. At times like this, it almost always does. He's the odd man out here, so he decides to get some air. He stands on the front step for a few moments, scanning the cars parked across the street, looking for a man sitting by himself in one of them. He sees no one, and realizes he hasn't seen Holly the Mumbler, either. He ambles around to the visitor's parking lot, and there she is, perched on the back step. She's dressed in a singularly unbecoming shin-length brown dress. Her hair is put up in unbecoming clumps at the sides of her head. To Hodges, she looks like Princess Leia after a year on the Karen Carpenter diet. She sees his shadow on the pavement, gives a jerk, and hides something behind her hand. He comes closer, and the hidden object turns out to be a half-smoked cigarette. She gives him a narrow, worried look. Hodges thinks it's the look of a dog that's been beaten too many times with a newspaper for piddling under the kitchen table.
Don't tell my mother. She thinks I quit.
Your secret's safe with me, Hodges says, thinking that Holly is surely too old to worry about Mommy's disapproval of what is probably her only bad habit. Can I share your step?
Shouldn't you be inside with Janie?
But she moves over to make room. Just taking a breather. With the exception of Janie herself, I don't know any of those people. She looks him over with the bald curiosity of a child.
Are you and my cousin lovers?
He's embarrassed, not by the question, but by the perverse fact that it makes him feel like laughing. He sort of wishes he'd just left her to smoke her illicit cigarette. Well, he says, we're good friends. Maybe we should leave it at that. She shrugs and shoots smoke from her nostrils.
It's all right with me. I think a woman should have lovers if she wants them. I don't myself. Men don't interest me. Not that I'm a lesbian. Don't get that idea. I write poetry.
Yeah, do you?
Yes.
And with no pause, as if it's all the same thing.
My mother doesn't like Janie.
Really?
She doesn't think Janie should have gotten all that money from Olivia. She says it isn't fair. It probably isn't, but I don't care myself.
She's biting her lips in a way that gives Hodges an unsettling sense of deja vu, and it takes only a second to realize why. Olivia Trelawney did the same thing during her police interviews. Blood tells. It almost always does. You haven't been inside, he says.
No, and I'm not going. And she can't make me. I've never seen a dead person. I'm not going to start now. It would give me nightmares.
She kills her cigarette on the side of the step, not rubbing it, but plunging it out, stabbing it until the sparks fly and the filter splits. Her face is as pale as milk glass. She started to quiver. Her knees are almost literally knocking. And if she doesn't stop chewing her lower lip, it's going to split open.
This is the worst part,
she says, and she's not mumbling now. In fact, if her voice doesn't stop rising, it will soon be a scream.
This is the worst part. This is the worst part. This is the worst part.
He puts an arm around her vibrating shoulders. For a moment, the vibration grows to a whole body shake. He fully expects her to flee, perhaps lingering just long enough to call him a masher and slap his face. Then the shaking subsides, and she actually puts her head on his shoulder. She's breathing rapidly. You're right, he says. This is the worst part. Tomorrow will be better.
Will the coffin be closed?
Yeah. He'll tell Janie it will have to be unless she wants her cuz sitting out here with the hearses again. Holly looks at him out of her naked face. She doesn't have a damn thing going for her, Hodges thinks. Not a single scrap of wit, not a single wile. He will come to regret this misperception. But for now, he finds himself once more musing on Olivia Trelawney, how the press treated her, and how the cops treated her, including him.
Do you promise it'll be closed?
Yes.
Double promise?
Pinky swear if you want. Then, still thinking of Olivia and the computer poisoned Mr. Mercedes Fetter, are you taking your medication, Holly? Her eyes widen.
How do you know I take Lexapro? Did she tell you?
Nobody told me. Nobody had to. I used to be a detective. He tightens the arm around her shoulders a little and gives her a small friendly shake. Now answer my question.
It's in my purse. I haven't taken it today because...
She gives a small shrill giggle.
Because it makes me have to pee.
If I get a glass of water, will you take it now?
Yes, for you.
Again, that naked stare, the look of a small child sizing up an adult.
I like you. You're a good guy. Janie's lucky. I've never been lucky in my life. I've never even had a boyfriend.
I'll get you some water, Hodges says, and stands up. At the corner of the building, he looks back. She's trying to light another cigarette. But it's hard going because the shakes are back. She's holding her disposable Bic in both hands like a shooter on the police gun range. Inside, Janie asks where he's been. He tells her and asks if the coffin can be closed at the memorial service the following day.